So, I guess we're ready to start some questions.
I believe so, yep.
All right. I have our first question is from Ida in Georgia. It says, how are peritoneal adhesions without obstructions coded?
Okay, so there are a couple of ways we can actually code peritoneal adhesions in ICD-10, and it's dependent upon the specificity provided. So if we refer to our ICD-10 CM index, we can see that we have a few options. First, we have code K66.0 for adhesions post-procedural or post-infective. Now, this includes adhesions of the abdominal wall, the diaphragm, the intestines, the male pelvis, the omentum, the stomach, and adhesive bands, and mesenteric adhesions. Now, if the adhesions are congenital, you would report code Q43.3. And then if the adhesions are pelvic and the patient is female, your options are going to depend on whether the adhesions are post-infective or post-procedural. If the adhesions are post-infective, you would use code N73.6. And then lastly, for post-procedural pelvic adhesions, peritoneal adhesions in a female, you would report code N99.4. So you really need a little more information because otherwise the answer is not so straightforward.
Okay, I understand. Wonderful. Okay, well, let's go to our next question. Our next one is from Carrie in South Carolina. She says, good morning. Do you know if RHC providers can bill rapid RSV code 87807?
Okay, so yeah, they can. Our CLIA regulations require a facility to be appropriately certified for each test performed, so that to ensure that CMS is only paying for laboratory tests categorized as waived complexity under CLIA facilities with the CLIA certificate of waiver. Laboratory claims are currently edited at the CLIA certificate level, and 87087 for infectious agent antigen detection by immunoassay with direct optical observation for respiratory syncytial virus is a test that is waived, meaning that the certification is not required to perform that test. Now, although RHCs and FQHCs are required to furnish certain laboratory services, it's not within the scope of the RHC or FQHC benefit. So when clinics and centers separately bill laboratory service, the cost of associated space, equipment, supplies, and facility overhead and personnel for those services has to be adjusted out of the RHC or FQHC cost report. And that's going does not include the venipuncture, which is included in the all-inclusive rate when it's furnished in the RHC or the FQHC by an RHC or FQHC practitioner and as a part of the RHC or FQHC visit.
Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds good. All right, so here's the next question then. This one is anonymous, and it's from an IRF or a inpatient rehab facility. And bear with me because I'm not used to all these words, but the anonymous writer states, this is from a rehab chart with the etiological diagnosis C1 through 5 or C1 through C5, internal fixation and fusion. Status post C2 cervical fracture, status post unstable burst fracture of first cervical vertebra, IGC 3.9, other neurologic therapy note, status post C1 through C5, internal fracture, fixation and fusion for non-healing C2 fracture. Had ACDF for C4 through 6 5 months prior to admit for central cord syndrome after fall. Physical exam, sensation to light touch, intact, normal range of motion for upper and lower extremities. Motor exam, C5 through C8 is 4 over 4, and T1 is 3 over 3. L2 through L5 is 4 over 4, and S1 is 4 over 4. Comorbidities, C2 cervical fractures, status post C1 through C5 fusion, impaired mobility transfers. Impaired ADLs, appropriate candidate for admit to rehab because of functional decline. Plan, consult PT for mobility, strengthening transfers and balance. OT for ADL, eval, and treatment of deficits. One note documents non-union C2 fracture. So I know a query would be needed for the etiologic diagnosis, as looks as if patient must just had surgery for the non-union fracture. My question is, does an IGC of 3.9, other neurologic, also require a neurologic diagnosis as etiologic diagnosis in addition to a fracture diagnosis? I would think this scenario would be a 8.9 unless, of course, there was a SCI or cord compression, etc., which might make the 3.9 appropriate. If two fractures and SCI or cord compression might also indicate the 14.3 spinal cord and multiple fracture or amputation.
Okay, so that's a lot of detail, but we are in agreement with you on that. I don't really see any neurological or cord deficits that you note in your scenario, so I would go with 8.9, and of course we would recommend you query, like you said, for the etiologic. As much as we'd like to put that patient in a different group, it doesn't sound like the documentation and focus of care would support it. Now, this is sort of what happened to Paula. She had a T6 three-column burst fracture, and the care was focused on maneuvering with the CTLSO and from the severe fracture. Now, luckily, there was no cord damage and no neurological residuals related to the fracture. And she says they should have been paid more, like a cord, for all the wonderful care she received, but in truth, and looking at the definitions of the IGC, 8.9 would be more appropriate if the fracture would have been her only injury. And also, just for any of you who are working in IRF, make sure you join our group, IRF the Whole Pie, on Facebook and LinkedIn, because you can always post questions to the group and get guidance both from those of us at AQIQ and from others in the group. So that's it's a great place to post your questions for the rehab.
Oh, wonderful. Yes, that's a great suggestion. Do we have time for one more, you think?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. This one is from Nicole. And she is in a physician practice. And her question is, can any provider bill ER CPT codes? Often we are called to see a patient in the ER that is our patient, so a consult is not correct. And our physician is unsure if to bill an OP code or an ER CPT.
Yeah, It can maybe seem a little strange, but the driver of the code selection itself is not whether the provider is employed by the ER or the hospital, or if the provider only treats in the ER or the ED. It's driven by the actual location where the service was provided. So any physician specialty can bill for ER EM services. There may be some billing issues when multiple providers submit claims to the same code range, but it really shouldn't be an issue. It does happen, and it can be reported when two specialties treat an ER patient on the same day if they're in two different specialties and practices. So payers look at provider tax IDs, specialties, and NPI numbers. And also you should keep in mind that if this is not a Medicare patient, the visit can actually be reported with a consultation code if the documentation rules are met for that. And if you're having any challenges getting paid from a specific payer, ask if they prefer that you use the 99201 through 99215 codes, because remember that definition is office or other outpatient.
Wow, that's a lot to remember. So wonderful. Well, I think our time is up. Thank you, Heather, and that was great. We need to draw for our winners. We've got one anonymous and three questions that we had answered. Let me shuffle here just a second, and we'll see who we pull out. And, oh, looks like Nicole's our winner today. Nicole, we'll get in touch with you and find out your contact information, but today's Nicole is our winner of the mugging, and so we will get with you and get that sent out. Join us next time, October 7th, for episode 74, and thank you all for showing up for today's episode. Tell your friends, send a question and comments, and let us know what you would like to hear in the insider portion. Join us for the insiders, and we'll see you next time. Or on our next webinar.